Hello and welcome back to Introduction to Information Systems. We are in week 5 already with our networking and communication module. So we're going to talk this week about all that communication that happens. But first, what I would really like to do is to start us off in a little prayer like we usually do. So if you'd like to join me in prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, I would like to thank you for each and every learner who comes across this content. I'd ask you to bless them as they go about learning these new topics and incorporating them into their life, into their homes, into their workplaces, into their ministries. This week especially, Lord, we are talking about networking and the importance of communication together and growing and learning together. And I pray that we can all use this content to best connect with each other for the benefit of you and your kingdom, that we can use these tools that have been given to us for connection, to feel connected like we never have before, Lord, and that this course hopefully will be giving someone the tools to do that, and for that we would be really grateful. So please look over us as we learn, and we're just so thankful. In your heavenly name we pray. Amen. So let's jump in, and we are going to be, here we go, we are in week 5, networking and communication. So talking about the learning objectives of what we're going to be doing this week. Here we go. Hi. By the end of this lecture, hopefully we're going to be able to understand the history and the development of the technologies that help us network. And of course, network is just another way of saying to communicate, to be able to have a message transmitted to somebody and pick it up on the other end, being able to really have that good communication. So we're going to understand the history of that communication with technology and how that's going to be developing in the future. There are so many really intricate, nuanced vocabulary, much like last week talking about the data. This week when talking about networking, there's just some key terms that we're going to need to really brush up on to really make sure that we understand and that we're speaking knowledgeably, especially if we are in a room of decision makers and we want to be a contributing voice to those conversations. We need to really be able to speak knowledgeably about networking and how those concepts work together. So we'll be able to identify some of those key terms and define those. We're going to be able to understand the importance of broadband technologies. For some of us, we don't remember anything before broadband technologies. Some of us certainly remember the dial-up sound happening to get us on the internet, and some people remember, you know, life before the internet. So we're going to talk about the importance of what broadband has really meant and continues to mean for us as a society and as a global entity. And then we're going to describe organizational networking for in our workplace and our for enterprise networking within your organizations. So that's on the agenda, and let's jump right in. I'm going to first talk about a brief history of the internet here. Here we go, and we're starting with that ARPANET, if we go all the way down into in the 50s, and this is going to be Advanced Research Projects Agency Network. So the ARPA, and which evolved into ARPANET Research Projects, was the first wide area packet switch network with distributed control, and one of the first networks to implement the TCP/IP protocol suite. You're probably thinking, what are you saying? We're going to get into that, into the protocols right now, and talk about TCP and IP protocols. But this is where it started, and this was first used for DoD and military purposes. These were for Pentagon-funded research projects that this structure was put into place. And then as you see, as we get closer and closer to the development of the World Wide Web, once we get to the 1995 area, that's going to be where we're going to pick up on the next slide. But so starting for a very specific, you know, military purposes, government-funded projects, and then you can see as we evolve here around the timeline to when we have our internet that we know now and the World Wide Web. So in the 80s, we'd see that those primary internet users were still government research organizations, academic purposes. It wasn't really the recreational internet that you would think of now, although there's certainly still academic and government and research applications in the internet, certainly. It certainly isn't filled with the video of cats like it is now. So at the dawn of email, once email was, you know, come onto the scene, do you remember when we were talking about killer applications two modules ago for software? This was one of those things where once email became a thing, people would go ahead and get the device and the personal computer specifically just for email capabilities. That's when it really was taken off. So there was a graduate student at the time, Tim Berners-Lee. You might recognize his name. He needed a way to link his dissertations and his advisor's comments together to have hypertext to be able to have two things talk to each other and link up. And so this became the World Wide Web project, and that's when Mosaic and Netscape Navigator were first on the scene in 1994. It's when you're going to see the internet and the World Wide Web really making a more of a home application. As a little sidebar, so when we were talking about the TCP and the IP protocol, this was designed really to allow networks that were running on different protocols to have an intermediary protocol that would allow them to communicate. So a common language that they had among them. So as long as your network supports TCP, IP, you could communicate with all the other networks that were running TCP and IP. So it became the standard protocol, and it allowed networks to communicate with each other. So this breakthrough is how we got that term internet, which really just means interconnected network of networks. So it's actually different from, the internet is different from the World Wide Web, although those do get thrown around together. So there you go. TCP, Transmission Control Protocol, TCP, and is with the IP, Internet Protocol. More than you ever wanted to know, right? All right. As we move forward here, we're going to talk about some internet vocabulary. And this, I'm sorry, it's a little dry, but some of these words you will recognize, and some of these words you might recognize that you've been using incorrectly. And we want to go ahead and remedy that so that you are really knowledgeable in your workplaces and in your homes, and that you can move some of these projects forward with, you know, just the right information. So we've got a couple things here that you might have heard before. We've got a packet. So a packet is that fundamental unit of data that's transmitted over the internet. So when a device intends to send a message to another device, for example, maybe your computer wants to send a request to YouTube to open up a video. You click the video and you're trying to get it to open. Your computer will break down that message into smaller pieces called little packets. Each packet has your IP address, the destination address, and a sequence number, and a piece of the overall message to be sent. So it's like a little code that says, here's who the person is, here's the final destination, here's what they want. It's this packet. It's breaking down your message into a smaller, manageable chunk to be sent. All right, we see next is the hub, which I don't think I put up there, so we're going to skip it and go to the bridge. Sorry about that. Bridge is a network device that connects two networks together and only allows packets through that are needed. It's kind of like a bouncer in a club. So it's going to be connecting those two networks, but it's not a free-for-all that you can request anything you want. It is going to be filtering those packets, only allowing through the ones that are necessary. The next one is a switch. And if you've heard of an internet switch, that's going to be a network device that connects multiple devices together and filters packets based on their destination within the connected devices. So having that filter in place is really going to allow you to control the final destination of your request. Okay? The router, hopefully if you have home internet, you would have seen this word router, which is often interchangeably, you know, you might use this incorrectly with your, there's so many things that you, as you're putting in your home internet, but what your router is a device that receives and analyzes packets, and then it routes them towards their destination. So it's different than your modem, which is what I couldn't think of a second ago. In some cases, a router is going to send a packet to another router. Sometimes it'll send it directly to its destination. So it's kind of like the post office of your internet connection and a post office of the network. The router does just that. It routes the packets of information where they need to go. The IP address. So every mobile device or every, it doesn't have to be a mobile device, every digital device that communicates on the internet, whether it's a PC, whether it's a tablet, a smartphone, anything else, is assigned a unique identifying number called an IP. So I'm sure you've seen an IP address, which is a list of numbers and periods. And historically, the IP address has been an IP version 4, which has four numbers between 0 and 255, and then there's a period. An example would be, I'm looking at my IP address right now, 107.23.196.166. That would be an example of an IP address. That is, it is mine right now where I am working. It has geographic implications. It can be routed back to my processing unit, to where I have my internet connection. But the number of IP addresses needed has gotten to the point now where that version 4, all the addresses are going to be exhausted, right? So we're just going to run out. So it led to the new IP version 6 standard, which is currently being phased in and actually is well on its way of being phased in. And that's formatted as 8 groups, 4 hexadecimal digits. And so it's a much longer IP address. And you're going to see in that there are alphanumeric characters as well. So the version 6 standard has a limit of, gosh, the amount of possible addresses is 3.4 times to the 1,038th power. So there's a lot of options, so we should be good for a while on the version 6 of IP addressing. Next, we have domain name. If you had to try to remember the IP address of every web server you wanted to access, the internet would not be a fun place for you and would not be very easy to use. So the domain name is a human-friendly name for a device on the internet. So it generally consists of some descriptive text followed by a top-level domain, or TLD. For example, let's say we want to go to Wikipedia. I don't recommend going to Wikipedia for really academic research, but it sure does have a lot of good information for us. So let's just use Wikipedia as an example. Wikipedia's domain name is wikipedia.org. And then they describe the organization. The Wikipedia describes what you're looking for. And then the .org is the top-level domain. So a lot of places that you're going to go, and most of them will have a .com. Some will have a .net, a .gov, depending on where you are, a .ca for a Canadian site. There's all kinds of these TLDs, those top-level domains. which is the dot whatever. So something that describes it, and then that TLD, top level domain, which all comes together for your domain name system, DNS. Almost done. We are at packet switching. And this is when a packet, so that tiny bit of information, is sent from one device out over the internet. It doesn't follow a straight path to its destination, though. Instead, it gets passed from one router to another across the internet until it reaches its final destination. So sometimes two packets from the same message will take different routes, even, which... So your request is really broken down into small pieces, and sometimes they don't get there the same way. Hopefully they'll both arrive at the same location. Sometimes they'll arrive out of order. But when this happens, the receiving device restores them back to their receiving order. That coding is done so that those packets can be put back together. And so that's packet switching, when it just takes a couple left turns on their way to their final destination. Finally, we have protocol, and we've used this word a couple times here when we talked about IP, but this is, in computer networking, a protocol is going to be the set of rules that allows two or more devices to exchange information back and forth across the network. So that set of rules is going to be important, just so that there are ground rules as we're exchanging that information in a network, and there's all kinds of different networks that we're going to be talking about in just a minute. Intranet, extranet. We can't make it simple for you. We have to make sure that there's lots of options. So hopefully these vocabulary, maybe some of them were very familiar to you already. Maybe this is all brand new information. You will likely see these again there as in the quizzes and things, but just want to make sure that you can speak knowledgeably. If someone is asking you about a packet, you'll automatically know that's a very tiny piece of information that's being sent across the internet. An IP address, you're going to know what that looks like and why the numbers are getting bigger right now instead of the version 4. Why did we move to a version 6? You're going to have that background knowledge and hopefully be able to speak knowledgeably about these things. So that was our vocabulary lesson, and so I'm sure you would love to move on from the vocab, so let's do that. Let's talk about internet usage over time. I'm going to let you see the whole thing here. And this is going to be, if we look back at January's over the last 10 years, this is in millions. So number of internet users in millions, year over year change. So if we look back into 2012, from 2012 to 2013, almost a 12% increase in internet users over the globe. This is a global overview, keep in mind. This isn't just for a national view. And so when we look here going forward, I mean, there's substantial growth each year, and it kind of varies, but once we get to January of 2022, if you look at that number, 4,950, keep in mind that's in millions, which means there are 4.95 billion internet users in January of 2022, according to Hootsuite, and We Are Social, who did this, were part of an advisory board of looking at internet usage across the globe. And so if you look at why, we had some really robust percentage gains, and now they seem to kind of be trending down, could possibly just be for complete saturation. You know, if an area is online, it's online. So as more and more people are getting and staying online and being able to see these benefits of being connected and of networking, I think we're going to continue to see that trend up until it really just has reached complete saturation, because 4.95 billion people is quite a lot of people. So just to give you an idea, when we're talking about these things of being online and being connected, we're talking about the vast majority of people in general. So being online... We talked about back in the early 90s, the USF, the Science Foundation, dropped oversight, internet oversight, to the government. So the government came out of policing, but they were overseeing the internet, which opened up e-commerce quite a bit. And in doing so, there we go. In doing so, once that the e-commerce really opened up, it really had a frenzy of people starting business, internet businesses, people investing in internet businesses. And if you've heard of the dot-com bubble in the early 90s, this was when that happened, of certainly many, many businesses failing and people losing a lot of money. And there were, if you look at the percentages of businesses that succeeded and had staying power during that time, Amazon is one that really comes out as a success story from that time period, but there were so many that failed. And some lessons learned there as part of that dot-com bubble, with, you know, the bubble meaning it was growing and growing, kind of this unregulated growth that wasn't at a healthy speed, and people kind of jumping into this e-commerce without being fully prepared. And so the bubble just kept growing until it wasn't sustainable. And they say that the dot-com bubble popped and had some very big failure stories coming out of that. So a lot of e-business companies needed to develop real business models that could, you know, as if they were opening a brick-and-mortar shop or solution or service, and to show that they could survive financially using this technology, that there was some education there and just some oversight and, you know, just some standards in place so that the consumers and the businesses would all, you know, be healthy. So that's kind of the history, if you've heard of the dot-com bubble, at this when the internet was really starting to be quite a thing. That's what we're talking about. If you've heard of Web 2.0, first let's start at Web 1.0. So before we talk about 2.0, Web 1.0. was more static pages on the internet. You could glean information, go to a web page, which was static, and read the information that was there, take away what you wanted. It was not an interactive experience. There was no comment section in the Web 1.0. So if you created a web page in the early days of Web 1.0, you were considered a webmaster. You could create a web page. You knew how to use the HTML language to create content as part of website pages, creating a domain name. You were the webmaster. But other people wanted in on this party too. So others wanted to create on the internet. They saw the potential, but they didn't have those skills. They weren't webmasters. So eventually, Web 2.0 was born. And what this did is it allowed regular people to go on and leave their footprint on the internet. They could interact with some of these websites. This is when the era of the blog was born. Sites like Blogger, where you could go in, you click create, and you started typing, and you push publish. You didn't have to know the HTML code for how to set up a page and how to have a colored background and how to center your text and how to insert, you know, spaces between your lines. It was all kind of templated for you. And as part of Web 2.0, things like Blogger, things like Wikipedia, where you could log in, leave your 2 cents, push save, push submit, push publish, and you were part of authoring the internet. And when that happened, that's when organizations like MySpace really took off. If anybody there remember MySpace, I really loved changing my songs on MySpace to really like dramatic, passive-aggressive, emotional things. So if I was really sad, I would pick a sad song so people would write and say, "What's wrong?" That ridiculous MySpace era. kind of glad that's a thing of the past at this point. But man, 2003, I got me some MySpace photo bucket. Being able to go on and just dump all your pictures online and be part of the internet of posting pictures on there that people could log in and see what you had created. That was in 2003 as well. Flickr, the same kind of photo sharing place on the internet in 2004. 2004 also brought us, of course, Facebook, where we could, as part of Web 2.0, you could interact with the internet without being a professional webmaster. You could go in, write on your wall, push publish, upload pictures, make comments, and change things about your profile without really being an expert in the field. So as part of Web 2.0, definitely Facebook made its mark. WordPress in 2005, if you ever had a WordPress website, made it very easy to have a templated website. You could actually create a whole site with multiple pages on your own without those webmaster skill sets. Same with Tumblr in 2006, and of course in 2006, the advent of Twitter. So then, you know, once Twitter was born, everyone needed to know what you ate for breakfast and what you planned to have for lunch and what your opinion was of the dress that someone wore to an awards dinner. So all of these things kind of just gave people a voice. So when Web 2.0 was born, we knew that it had really taken hold when Time magazine named you its Person of the Year in 2006, because you meant all of you. You are authoring the internet. You are interacting. You are creating. You are making things that weren't there yesterday, and they are there today because you put your footprint on the internet because of Web 2.0. Now we're seeing Web 3.0 at this point in time, which, you know, take this class in a couple of years and we'll look back on this time fondly and do the same kind of thing. Here we go. I've been saying how you heard me saying that the internet and the World Wide Web, they're not the same thing. They do get thrown around kind of interchangeably, but they're definitely not the same thing. Internet and World Wide Web, or if you say the web, really they're not the same thing at all. The internet is an interconnected network of networks. Okay? The World Wide Web is one part of the internet, if that makes sense. So many services run across the internet. Email, voicemail, videos, file transfers, and the World Wide Web. So the internet is a more higher arching entity. So if you're one of those people, like I even did during this lecture of using the web interchangeably with the internet, it's just not a correct statement. So we know that the internet exists, and then if we drill down a little further, the World Wide Web is one part of the internet that you can go to. You good? Okay. We're going to leap forward to broadband connection. Here we go. And with the growth of broadband, if we look at the 70s and 80s, people used dial-up modems to connect to the computer. If you had the opportunity, there we go. If you had the opportunity to be one of those people who can very distinctly remember that sound of a dial-up modem right now, you know that it tied up your phone lines. If you were trying to be online and someone in your household needed to make a phone call, you needed to end your internet session to use the phone line. It was very slow. Its speed was measured in BPS, bytes per second. Then we had the cable, or DSL, which offered higher speeds. Satellite in certain areas also you could use for this. And then the broadband connection. The broadband isn't a type of connection. It doesn't mean that you're using a cable or an optic wire. It just means that you have a connection that's faster than 256,000 BPS. And that's a very minimal standard. At this point, speeds are much higher now, typically for a connection that you would have. The average home broadband speed is between 3 and 30 Mbps. Now, if we think back to our going to our prefixes, that's going to be our mega BPS, which is much faster than the BPS. So we've kind of outgrown this. We might need to up what indicates broadband. And then it has enabled growth of new businesses and ways that people use the technology. Just because the faster our internet connection is, the more easily we can transfer files, we can communicate across long distances, we can share documents, we can do all these things that weren't possible before this high level of broadband. Now, in 2011, in Geneva, it was decided there was a summit, internet summit, and it was kind of determined that having access to a broadband internet connection was no longer a luxury. That was a basic human right. So if you think of how far we've come, if we look back to in the 50s where the internet was, the ARPANET was going to be just that military context, and you're thinking DOD, you're thinking Pentagon-funded projects that were not in our homes. We weren't playing games across countries and doing those kind of things on the internet. From there, within a 60-year span, going from that to it's a basic human right for everyone globally to have access to not just the internet but to broadband connections, faster than 256 BPS. It's pretty incredible of that growth in just 60 years. And you just wonder how fast, how much faster could it get? I guess we'll see. All right. Let's talk about wireless internet connections. There we go. And wireless internet connections, we're talking about either Wi-Fi or mobile networking. So the difference of this, of course, if you're on your smartphone or your tablet and or your home computer, you connect to Wi-Fi. A lot of people are doing this from home or from work. The mobile networking is when you're actually using your cell phone data. Think about if you're not connected to Wi-Fi and still on the internet, that would be your mobile networking. And then Bluetooth and VoIP. This VoIP, the voice over internet protocol, is going to be having sounds converted to a digital format for transmission over the internet. So think using Skype, using Google Hangouts, things that aren't necessarily, you don't have a telephone call, but your information in terms of the input of your voice is being communicated over the internet for that VoIP-enabled wireless networking. So just one more way to do that. All right. Let's talk about some organizational networking. So if you were not confused already by, let's say there's a difference between the World Wide Web and the internet, I'm going to throw a monkey wrench in there now, and we're going to talk about the intranet, the extranet, and the internet, all different things. So we're going to look at the intranet first. This is just within an organization, okay? And this is if your organization has a really closed network that you can only communicate with each other and share data with each other in that closed network. It's not open internet. You can't give someone the DNS address, and they would be able to find it. This is a closed, you need a login and password to get in. This is an intranet. An extranet is still private. It's not the open web, but it allows partners into your network for specific things. Like if you have a supply chain management issue, you need a vendor to come into a conversation, that would be useful here for this extranet. So it's a little more broad, but still private. Let's say you wanted to give someone temporary access, then you would just give them a private connection. I'm going to ask my friend off camera, that thing you use to keep a private connection. Thank you. couldn't think of it, VPN. So they would issue a VPN to that employee if they wanted them to have access to the extranet. But so to keep that private status, they would give them a VPN to use. And then finally, as we get bigger, you can see the outer ring here is the internet. And we're going to, here's more about the, here we go. So in the very center of that circle, we can see the LAN, which is a local network. It's usually operating in the same building or on the same campus. And then when an organization needs to provide a network over a wider area, they're using a WAN, which is just a wide area network. Just depends on the need of the intranet or the extranet. All right, so sometimes an organization will need to allow someone who's not physically located to gain access. Again, like we said, it's going to be that virtual private network, the VPN, and we're going to be talking about VPNs a lot more in Chapter 6 next week, in Week 6, because we're going to be talking all about security, and VPNs are going to be a big part of what we're discussing next week, so we'll get into that. But you can see in the visual here kind of the benefits of using one over the other. So if you want a totally closed network versus a partially closed network, both are private and both allow for collaboration, but on one end it's just your employees collaborating and the others it's also with partners. So we're going to move right along to a server farm or a data farm. And the visual here, sorry, it's not the best graphic, it's just a visual representation of where these server farms and these data centers are located across the globe. And these are Google's data centers. And here's what those are. So that map was these big centralized cooling centers of data. So where all those packets that we were talking about earlier, those tiny pieces of information that get broken apart into their smallest pieces in these packets and then sent to their final destinations to be put together again, these data farms are where that happens. So this Fjord-cooled data center in Norway is the world's greatest data center. You can see here cooled, you know, these, as you can imagine, these processors are create tremendous amounts of heat. So of Facebook is building a server farm at the Arctic Circle to battle this. There's some companies are really getting creative to do that. By taking advantage of naturally occurring climates, a data center can be much more environmentally friendly instead of a total drain. So other economies that a large facility can offer in terms of a data farm, labor. Since the labor is effectively outsourced, you don't have to pay for as many people to maintain the data center. And then, of course, you can have scaling. Since the cloud company has a giant server base, if your firm needs more or less computing power, that company using dynamic scaling can increase or decrease on the fly, kind of like a just-in-time basis, but for data. And then backup and recovery, as we see here. And then cost. So all the above, all these things can have a significant cost savings to your company in using these data farms in a third party rather than trying to house an entire server, a secure server, with all these climate-controlled conditions on your own as an organization. All right. Cloud computing. We talked about cloud computing a lot in the previous two modules. It does have implications here for networking as well, so we're going to just touch on that for the cloud computing. Here's some problems. So we already talked about all the benefits that we get from cloud computing. Security is definitely an issue. Access, if you lose internet power, it's over. You can't save to the cloud if your device is not participating in an active internet connection. It's not always easy, and service from a giant host might not be as good as what you would get in-house. If you're using Amazon Web Services, it might not be as personalized as you would attend to it in your own organization, of course. And then you are locked into a specific service provider for a certain amount of time if you do agree to cloud computing. So that's not just storage. Remember, this can be computing activities where you're processing large amounts of data that you could not do in-house. You don't have the processing speed, so you would go to a third party for that. And so here are the potential problems with cloud computing. All right. Services from the cloud. So we've got platform as a service, the PaaS, software as a service. I'm sure you've heard of the SaaS, the software as a service, and infrastructure as a service. So it's not just like goods and services you're purchasing. You're actually purchasing the processing power, the storage power, virtual machines, the AI needed to run these as a service features. So if you are a cloud client, you have access now to offer your clients big CRM and email platforms, and you can make applications to offer your clients where you don't have to be an expert. Like we said, you don't have to be a webmaster in order to make a website. The same way now, you don't have to be an expert to offer your clients or your family even some of these larger machine learning capabilities, AI, and some of these other servers that, you know, you would only have access to in the cloud with this group sharing mentality. So do you remember when we were talking about Moore's Law two modules ago? We talked about how the processing speed, the processing speed really did catch up every 2 years, that it doubled in speed. And how they said in 2022, they thought maybe Moore's Law would be dead, which has not been the case yet. And we're looking still at a very positive trajectory for that. So this is going to be pretty similar to Moore's Law, how that describes computing power increasing. We're going to talk about Metcalfe's Law. And Metcalfe's Law states that the value of a telecommunication network is proportional to the square of the number of connected users of the system, which is a tricky way to say, if none of your friends were on Facebook, would you bother to ever log into Facebook? Probably not. That's the benefit of having a connected network and the draw of being there. If nobody at your workplace or your school or your family used email, would you find a need to get a computer and have that killer app that we talked about to buy to buy a computer for the killer app of email, the application? Probably not. So Metcalfe's Law tries to quantify that value of people bringing people. And as you saw, that graphic of 4.95 billion internet users in January of 2022, Metcalfe's Law seems to still be right on in its predictions. So once you see, if you see that Metcalfe's Law, think of Moore's Law, but instead of processing speed, we are talking about the benefit of connected telecommunication networks. All right, which brings us to our summary. Sorry, hang on. There we go. Mic check. Hope that didn't hurt. Sorry. Our summary that we have reviewed the history of the internet and the development of networking technologies, where we came from, where we're going in terms of being interconnected and having these networks together. We defined those key terms associated with networking technologies. We talked about packets and addresses and all of those internet protocols and things that could have those nuanced differences in definition. And so for you to be able to go into a room full of decision makers and speak knowledgeably about these nuanced differences of vocabulary could really set you apart. And hopefully we talked about, hopefully you've got those distinctions in definitions. Now we reviewed the importance of the broadband technology and even went so far as to, in 2011, how at the Geneva summit that access to a broadband connection was considered a basic human right, which is a massive leap forward from the 50s when it was just a military wish instead of a home a basic right for those all around the globe. And then we described organizational networking at a high level and kind of what that looks like and the pros and cons of cloud computing in terms of networking. So hopefully you've got it. So next week, we're going to be coming through with information systems security. Or so those VPNs are going to be back next week, along with lots of other topics that are going to help keep our organizations, our families, as safe as possible and as productive as possible when using some of these networking technologies. So looking forward to seeing you next week, and thank you so much.